Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are a go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we are speaking to author Jeff Meek. He has been on the show many times, and also there is a JFK Files Volume 2 review is out on Kennedy's and King by Mr. Jeffrey Meek. Hello, Jeff.
Hello there, Len. How you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for taking time today to talk to us about your good work.
You're welcome. Appreciate you contacting me.
Kennedy's and King is featuring you again. This is out, I think, May 5th, so it's already been out a couple, 2 weeks or so. But last time we just barely brushed on it, and Jim said you should have Jeff on to really go into it in depth. There's a lot here to this volume two, which is worthwhile.
Yeah, he wrote a very nice review for me, and I didn't even have to pay for it. How about that?
Okay, well, just give us an overview, what the JFK files.
Okay, well, let's see. It would have probably been in late 2021. Now living in Texas, I was the managing editor of the Hot Springs Village Voice newspaper, which is in Arkansas, in Hot Springs Village. It's a gated retirement community, the largest in the country, 26,000 acres with 11 lakes and 8 golf courses, a great place to live. But our son and his family moved from California to the Frisco, Texas area, and shortly after that, we decided to move over here. And once I was over here in North Texas, you know, I was pretty much immersed in the JFK thing more so than when I was in Arkansas. And every once in a while, even though I wasn't really officially on the newspaper staff anymore, I would send in a little something about the Kennedy assassination. For example, I went down to the Sixth Floor Museum and I listened to G. Robert Blakey and Howard Willens do a talk down there. And so I wrote that up and the newspaper used it. And I think I wrote one other thing, and it wasn't too long after that, that the newspaper office was hearing from the public and saying, how come there wasn't anything about the Kennedys in the newspaper this week? It's a weekly paper. And the answer, of course, was send us anything. So the idea came up to do a monthly column, and we settled on the JFK files. So I started writing that about 4 years ago, and it has been very popular. And I was in a discussion, chatting one day with Chris Gallup about the book, and he said, well, why don't you put all these articles that you've written in a book? It would get wider distribution. So we did the JFK Files, Pieces of the Assassination Puzzle, Volume 1, years ago, and I put in many of the interviews that I did. And just a few months ago came out with a Volume 2, with more that I've done recently, and some that I didn't bring up when we did Volume 1. I included in Volume 2 some interviews I did many years ago that I thought were significant and interesting. For example, many years ago, I interviewed Dale Hill, who, according to the Dallas Police Radio transcripts, was a couple hours after the assassination, he was sent down to Cobb Stadium to look for a man with a rifle. And down near Cobb Stadium. And so I got in touch with him and asked him about that. And he said, no, he said, I never went down there to do that. And I said, well, that's what the radio logs say that you did. And he said, no, I really didn't. And so, you know, the transcripts also talk about, you know, taking a look at the suspects. They call it a suspect's vehicle. And so J. Gary Shaw and I were doing some things on Jean Rene Sweater at that time, so I was in touch with Gary quite a bit back then. And so I got in touch with Gary to see if he knew anything, and he did. He was able to locate the license number and the registration, and both the address and the name on the vehicle registration turned out to be fictitious. So I thought that's pretty weird. Officer Hill denies going there, even though the logs say he did, and then the vehicle registration turns out to be phony. And that's where it stayed. I ended up trying to talk with Mark Lane about it a couple of years later, and he said he would bring it up with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And I don't know if he ever did, but there's no mention of it in any of the HSCA documents or reports, at least that we've seen in public. So that was a strange one.
What's behind that then?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's complete denial by the officer. You know, Gary, helping me out, you know, looked into the vehicle registration, and there was no 2521, I think, was 2521 Waldrum Street in Grand Prairie was the address, and there is no such address. Nothing there, at that time, at least.
That's why I'm asking you, what do you think that means, Ray?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, it would appear that way because, you know, I was careful in paying attention to the police radio log and the patrol car number and made sure I had the right police officer to go with the patrol car number, and that was Officer L.L. Hill. But he denied it even when I said, well, it's on the police radio transcripts that you were there. No, I wasn't there. So, again, like so many other things, as you suggest, where does that lead? What does that mean? And we don't really know. But the facts are that the logs and that name and address that's on the vehicle registration turned out to be fictitious. That part we do know. Want me to talk about a couple other?
Yes, please.
Articles in the book? Okay. Well, one that wasn't in the Hot Springs Village Voice, the JFK Files column. There's a couple of things also in the book that I wrote for George Magazine, the magazine that JFK Jr. started in the mid-90s, and then it folded up there for a while, but it's back up and running now for over 2 years. And I wrote a three-part story about Gayton Fonzie. And I was going through some things in all the things that I've accumulated over the years, and I came across that article that he wrote in November of 1980 in the Washingtonian magazine. I don't know if you've ever seen it or read it, but it was the precursor to the great book he wrote years later called The Last Investigation. And so I'm rereading this lengthy, it's a long, long, long article. And, you know, I thought, boy, you know, Gayton Fonzie was one of the best, in my opinion, and many others. And, you know, I thought, I want to write about him. So I pitched the idea to the CEO at George Magazine, and he said, go for it. And so I wrote a three-part article on Gayton Fonzie and his work. And, you know, I wanted to add a little different pitch to it. And so I was able to get in touch with Gayton Fonzie's wife, Marie, and over a period of about 3 weeks or so, we talked numerous times on the phone because I wanted to add to what most people know about Gayton, but what about the behind-the-scenes thing? What was he like? What were his interests? How did he get started? And that kind of thing. And she was really, really helpful. I think Jimmy mentions this in the Kennedys and King piece that he published for me. And, you know, just make it a more of a personal Gayton Fonzie-like thing. For example, she talked about how when he got the call from Senator Schweiker about investigating the Kennedy assassination. And Marie said, you know, we were standing in the kitchen, and he hung up, and he looked at me, and he said, I'm going to help solve the Kennedy assassination. And they just danced around the kitchen. And, you know, I learned about that he loved to go sailing on his boat, and his background and other things he had written before he became pretty well known in the JFK assassination community. But so that's in there. There's another three-part article in there that I wrote for George. It's kind of an overview of the investigations that took place. Then I cover a lot of the threats and misinformation that have come out over the years. And then the third part is more speculative. It's on who I think and what I think. But I was able to do another interview many years ago that I included in the book that I'd never really talked about anybody with before. And I don't, again, what does this mean? I don't know. It's weird. I was reading through many years ago, Mary Farrell and I would spend time together going through documents. I would come and visit her from our home in Illinois and drive down to Texas and spend a week with her. And I came across a Central Intelligence Agency document, and it had this guy's name in it, Russell McLary, and that he was a suspect in the Kennedy assassination. So I was able to locate him, and I found out that weeks after Oswald was dead, he was arrested as a suspect in the Kennedy assassination, and he said they tried to tie me to Oswald. And apparently some students at the University of Texas at Arlington, I think it was, had contacted law enforcement and said that Russell McLary had made a threat towards President Kennedy, and he's working over in the trademark area. And so, I mean, they arrested him. He had to bond himself out. He went to court over the whole matter, and he was really upset about the whole thing, as you can imagine. But, you know, I asked him, you know, what do you make of this? I mean, this is weeks later. You know, everybody in the world is being told it's Lee Harvey Oswald alone, and then they arrest you and try to tie you to him. And, I don't know what to make of it, he said. So that one was pretty weird. And you can go online and search Russell W. McLary, and you'll see pictures of him, you know, being arrested and so on. Another interview that I did that I just thought was kind of interesting, doesn't solve anything, but I interviewed one of President Kennedy's pallbearers, Tim Cheek. And, he talked about, this the unit and how they prepare for burials and all this and that. But the thing that kind of jumped out at me is, they had this very heavy ceremonial casket that Kennedy was in. And they were really worried about going up and down the Capitol steps with this big, heavy casket. And so they assigned a couple other people to help carry the casket. And to practice, the night before, they were out at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and they put a soldier on top of the casket while they practiced going up and down stairs with some added weight. Again, that doesn't solve anything, but something I'd never heard about. So those are some examples of what's in Volume 2. Also interviewed Lee Sanders, who was a Dallas police officer at the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And he was there for traffic control because, as you know, they were doing acoustical testing. And he talks about how one of the department's sharpshooters, I think his last name was Compton, I'd have to look in the book to make sure, but, when they'd take a break, he would came out of the Texas School Book Depository, and we're talking to some of the officers and told him, he said, we're really struggling trying to match what Oswald supposedly did. And Sanders told me that none of the officers he knew believed that Oswald did it alone. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, struggling, he didn't shoot, you can't do it. So.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think anybody could have done what Oswald is alleged to have done with that rifle that Eugene Boone found on the sixth floor. Another interview that's in the book is Eugene Boone's son talks about his father and finding the rifle and what his father thought.
Carlos Hathcock was the famous sniper, and he said he couldn't recreate it.
Yeah, well, just my opinion, I don't even think Oswald was on the sixth floor myself.
No, I mean,
I think Barry Ernst, in his book, The Girl on the Stairs, did a terrific job of staying on that with trying to locate Victoria Adams, and she and some other women are in that staircase when Oswald was supposed to be there, and they didn't see anybody, they didn't hear anybody. I think Oswald was right where he said he was, the second floor lunchroom.
Now, you wrote the first book, just the JFK Files, and now this is the JFK Files Volume 2. What was the catalyst to make you say, look, I've got to add to this, it's just too much?
Well, again, just chatting with some other JFK assassination friends, you know, I told them I've got, you know, several other interviews. Of course, I kept doing more interviews after the book, Volume 1, came out. And just in talking to others, I said, well, you need to do a Volume 2. So I talked to my publisher, Ravens Inn Press, and he said, yeah. He said, all we got to do is add Volume 2 to the cover, and you'll be good to go. So readers of these articles will not find many instances where I give my opinion on something. And I got criticized for that by one researcher. And, you know, I tried to explain, and I do so in Volume 2, that, you know, the book isn't about me. The book is about what I've learned from others, from, let's call them, players in the assassination saga. And I write the articles, and I've put them in book form, and will continue to do the articles and the interviews in hopes that readers find it interesting, and maybe it will help them with their research. That's why that's the impetus for doing it, is just to try to learn what I can and share it with others. And in some instances, not many, I put my two cents in there. But, you know, I guess it's the reporter in me. When I got into journalism as a second career after no journalistic experience to begin with, I was taught by a man by the name of Frank Leeming, who used to work for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and now in retirement he was the managing editor of the Hot Springs Village Voice newspaper. So, you know, everything I learned through him and you know, by the seat of my pants. And he always emphasized that, you know, as a reporter, you're like a fly on the wall. You report the news, you don't make the news. You don't try to be a part of the story. And so that's how I learned it. That's how I write almost everything I write. Not 100% of things I write do I keep my opinion out of, but for the vast majority of things, you'll read a story and you won't know how I think about it. And again, it's how I was trained as a reporter. True journalism, in my opinion. You don't take sides. I remember once I wrote an article about a deer hunt that was going on in Hot Springs Village, and I was at church Sunday, and this lady came up to me and she said, you know, Jeff, she said, I didn't know you disliked animals. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, you wrote this article about harvesting deer. And I said, what you read in the article is not what I think. It's what was said at the meeting. You won't see what I think in my articles, because that's not how we report. We're not like Fox or CNN. We don't interject or take sides. We report. You can decide.
Right. I guess what I was asking, was there a new piece of information or another interview that you did that really said, oh, I've got to add to the book. People have got to know about this item.
Well, I thought the Sanders one was interesting about how they couldn't, you know, duplicate what Oswald did. I also interviewed Antoinette Giancana, Sam's daughter. That got a lot of interest when it showed up in the newspaper, and so I thought, you know, that would be a good one to share. You know, she believes that the CIA was behind her father's murder, and what I didn't know that she shared with me was that, you know, Sam was going to be called to testify before the church committee, and what I didn't know is Antoinette was going to be called, and her father, Sam, put her in a mental institution so she couldn't go.
Wow, I didn't know that, yeah.
And so, you know, so finding out those kinds of things, again, trying to disseminate information that I've learned through these interviews, I thought, well, let's go ahead and do a Volume 2. You got another 30, 40 stories here. Let's do it. And I also put in the book an interview I did many years ago that was in one of my other books, The Manipulation of Lee Harvey Oswald and the Cover-Up That Followed. Many years ago, I interviewed a Marine that was in Oswald's unit. He was also a radar operator there at Atsugi. And the only other place I've seen, this fellow's name is Ron Crawley, and I've the only other place I'd ever seen his name mentioned was in Armstrong's book, Harvey and Lee, and he's just mentioned in a list. And then in the book, The Missing Chapter, there's a little bit about Ron Crawley in there, but they didn't ask the questions that I asked. And I asked him, you know, you ever, first of all, Ron said the CIA was all over at Tsugi Naval Air Station, where the U-2s were flying out of. And I said, Ron, were you ever asked to do any special assignments? And he said, I can't talk about that. And I said, what about Oswald? And he said, well, he would leave the base for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And to me, that meant more than once. That was my interpretation. And so, you know, ask yourself, how does a Marine leave a Marine Corps base, a Naval Air Station, for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and then come back and not be considered AWOL? You don't. The only way you can get away with that is you left with permission. And I believe that's when the CIA recruited Lee Harvey Oswald, was while he was at Atsugi. So although I had mentioned that in a previous book, I put it in this book too, because I think it's extremely significant.
I mean, you find the intelligence community everywhere. You're looking at the removal of the president, and I just can't get over that people in this day and age still take their time to say Lee Oswald did it. He's a lone assassin. And you've got to put your head in the sand like an ostrich or whatever. You know, it's like, I have to ignore everything and just take up the fraudulent Warren Commission position that there was a lone gunman.
And as you know, Len, 50 years ago, Senator Schweiker said something like the fingerprints of intelligence are everywhere you look when it comes to Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, CIA operatives were in the courtroom when Oswald was, after his arrest in New Orleans. I mean, they're just everywhere.
Well, you know, fingerprints is being kind and conservative about it, because as you start looking, just the fact that they brought in George Joannides to clamp down on everything, it says they're not only complicit, but they're keeping the cover-up going for years and years and years, even though there's these document releases by Trump to some extent. The real people have been somehow glossed over. You know, you've heard about Alan Dulles, you've heard of Lansdale or Cabal and his brothers, the mayor of Dallas, right, you know. And the awful sixth-floor museum, which is like a headquarters for the cover-up.
Yeah, you know, to your point, still, as far as I know, as of last week, we're still waiting for the Joannides file to be released. It's my understanding that Jefferson Morley has said that Anna Paulina Luna, task force chairwoman, you know, she specifically asked the CIA for it. And as of last week, I don't think we've got that yet. So to your point, Len, you know, they're still trying to withhold that. And I don't think they'd do that unless there was some real significance there that showed, you know, in detail, another example of the CIA all over Lee Harvey Oswald, surveilling him, opening his mail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think they're the foot soldiers in this. The CIA is just an agency for the intelligence community. And so they're all over that their masters are the Alan Dulles and the Sullivan Cromwell and the big money of America. And when they plan for moving drugs, the Golden Triangle, Afghanistan, wherever they've got to go, or oil.
I think we were going to talk about one other thing in the book that I thought was interesting, so I included it. And that was an interview I did with Janet Bannister, Guy Bannister's great, great, great niece.
Okay.
And she shared with me family conversations and what they thought about Guy Bannister. And she talked about several things. I don't want to give it all away of what's in the book, but I asked her if she believed that Oswald could have been in Guy's office. And she said, yeah, but I think it was in a different context. And we talked about, you know, the address is 544 Camp Street and 531 Lafayette Street. And she said that she found it far more likely that the 544 Camp Street address was a dig at Carlos Bringer to get under his skin, and that the family felt that Hoover, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, had Bannister, a former FBI agent, keeping tabs on Oswald. That's what the family thought.
Well, that's interesting, you know, because that's... keeping tabs on somebody, meaning, you know, that there's all these intelligence operations going on. not a disgruntled Marxist, you know. I mean, just the fact that he was sent on this defector program, that anybody who spends a minute into it, looking into it, goes, oh, this is an orchestrated effort, right? You know?
Yeah.
What about all the other guys that went over there, right? And the whole thing. And then when he comes back, he's given money to come back. Oh, and by the way, he can bring his Russian bride and no grilling.
Yeah. Well, and she, Janet, another thing Janet said is that she and the family felt that Guy was CIA connected, especially around the time of the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, and it's just a hotbed of intelligence activity with, you know, Miami and everything to do with Cuba and South America.
Yeah. And I asked her, I said, you know, bottom line, do you think Guy was involved in the JFK assassination? And she said, I don't think he was in on it, but the family always felt that he was working for Hoover.
And Hoover hated the Kennedys. And
sure
when
did.
The big businessman that Alan Dulles would be talking to, they said, look, that guy's got to go. We got to get rid of him. He says, okay, don't worry. I'll take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes downhill from there.
Yeah.
So all these people are only too willing. I mean, it just amazes me even right now that Trump, love him or hate him, that assassination attempt, and it just hit his ear. He turned his head, and this kid got up on the roof, and somehow he had a rifle, and he had a ladder, and a rangefinder, and there's no investigation. There's no big commission. There's no, like, no, we were behind this one as well. We don't want to bring any of that up. I can't believe that they're not making more of it, but they're not.
Yeah, you know, there's this kid that crawls up on that white roof, and you don't see him until he's laying down fire, shooting at the...
Oh, he's there for half an hour. Other people were yelling, warning, filming him with their cell phones, right?
Yeah.
But I just mean, you know, now people have got that. But back then, it's like Guy Bannister and all these other people. Yeah, I mean, like, how'd that guy get in with the rifle? How'd he get in with the ladder, you know?
Yeah.
How'd...
How do you sneak into a venue with a ladder? It's crazy.
Just like they... let Ruby in down the basement. How do you get there right in front of the Lee, you know, with the gun there?
Yep.
You know, like in the JFK movie, you can see the guy open the side door, open the basement door, and okay, come on in now, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we're waiting to move him until you got here. We've been waiting for you.
Yeah. You know, another thing, when I watched the video of President Trump almost getting his head blown off, you know, you think of the Zapruder film, which was filmed from X number of yards away, and you can see Kennedy's head explode. Just think if that bullet would have found his mark and hit Trump in the head, you know, he's close up on the camera, we would have seen the back of his head blown off. It would have just been so disturbing.
Well, what I found disturbing was that CNN never covered any of his... rallies, but they were there with all the cameras that day, as if someone said, you should really be here today.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody asked me the other day when we were talking about Kennedy and how he bucked the system and didn't trust the CIA, the Schlesinger memo, which has now been declassified. You know, I just wrote about that recently. You know, it does a great job of showing how the CIA was everywhere. And we were talking about Trump, and they said, you know, he's kind of in this same Kennedy mode. You know, he's just going about doing his thing. And if people don't like it, it's too bad. You think Trump might be in danger. And I said, well, they've already tried to kill him twice. So, yeah, I think it's certainly possible.
Yeah, and I made the point that when Trump wanted to release the files 4 years ago or so, he was all up for it. And then the next day he said, oh, no, we're postponing it. So somebody came in and had a talk with him and said, you're not doing it. You know, so there's the power that you think that the president, you know, the buck stops here. But no, somebody came in and said, look, we're not doing that. We're not doing that now.
Yeah. One of the pieces that's in the JFK files, pieces of the assassination puzzle, volume two, Jimmy D. Genio mentioned it in his review of my book, was something I found on the internet. It wasn't an interview that I did, but it was an interview done on television. And it was with Christine Niedermeyer, who was on the HSCA staff. And she talked about a very unnerving situation when during the investigation, she was in some back and forth with an FBI agent, I think it was. And, they would talk about this, that, and the other thing and what they thought. And she ended up getting a phone call from an intelligence agent of some kind. I don't know, have any idea. I've never been able to find her to question her more about it. And this agent was like, hey, how's it going at Georgetown? And how are your friends doing? And he made it very obvious to her that he knew all about her. And he told her, you've got a really bright future. And Christine felt that there was a very good possibility that there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. And talk of a conspiracy was not welcome around the HSCA staff. And this person that contacted her said, you've got a very bright future. You might want to reconsider how you think. That's also in the book. Again, I think that's just one of several examples of intimidation and threats that have gone on over the years.
And that's unfortunate that, sitting in the sidelines, you think, I hope that this, commission or Rockefeller or AARB, I hope they get up. And then you find out that from the top down, they don't want it exposed. A few people, dig up a few things. You mentioned Hardway and Eddie Lopez and the medical evidence that has been written about, right? Otherwise, from the top down, though, they could try to keep a lid on things. And you're just surprised. I was surprised after the fact to find out that there were people on these commissions that were not, let's dig up everything. Let's leave no stone unturned.
Yeah. Lip service.
Yeah, we read about, a lot of killed witnesses over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate. And this analogy, anecdotal kind of as it is, it's like, well, if you take her at her word that somebody got to her, like they said, look at, you could just look back at the number of people, Bruce Pfitzer, right? William Bruce Pfitzer?
Mm-hmm.
Just so many people that said they were going to dig up something and then, boom, they're gone.
Yeah. Just as a tease to those who might be interested in reading the book, volume two, part of my Fonzie interview with Marie, she told me what she told me about Gayton getting in touch with George de Morenshield, and then shortly thereafter he was dead. Marie tells me what Gayton thought about that. I'm going to leave it at that as a tease.
Right. Where is the book available right now? We're going to make a link to it, but
It's on Amazon. If somebody's interested in an autographed copy, they can email me at jmlunker, L-U-N-K-E-R, jmlunker at suddenlink.net, jmlunker at suddenlink, like all of a sudden, jmlunker at suddenlink.net. The book is $15, and I'd be glad to autograph it if somebody's interested in an autographed copy.
Okay, good. Yeah, and you can figure out postage as well then. Yeah, that's pretty reasonable. Good.
Yeah.
So,
the purpose of the books, as we said a little earlier in our conversation, is just to share what I've learned and hope that it helps other researchers in looking at the aspect of the case that they're involved in.
One other name of somebody that you looked into and discussed a little bit is the Ricky White, Roscoe White.
Yeah.
Do you have any opinions on that you want to just talk about right now?
Well, I tell you this. If you read Admitted Assassin by Brian Edwards and J. Gary Shaw and Ricky, it's awfully convincing. And I sat in his home to do that interview. I mean, just 2 feet away from him, sitting in his kitchen. And he's just very convincing. I mean, this guy, he's just a normal guy. And I asked him, what do you say to the people that don't believe what you're saying. And he said, you know, I can't help that. I can't help you. I'm just telling you what I've lived and what I've experienced. And I know others, you know, have feel that they've debunked all this, and, you know, there's opinions on both sides. But after the book came out, Ricky was visited by a couple of Dixie Mafia figures and basically told to keep his mouth shut. So if there's nothing to the story, why would that happen?
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I asked who, he wouldn't give me their names.
So their point was taken.
Yeah, that, shut up.
Yeah. Well, I guess people will have to read the book and come to their own conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Gary, Shaw and I, of course, I know Brian, but not as well as I've known Gary for 50 years. You know, he told me that that could have easily been a 700 or 800 page book, that there was just so much evidence to believe that Roscoe was a shooter. And like I said, just sitting there with Ricky and his wife there in their kitchen, he's so believable and so sincere. And, you know, he just, to me, doesn't look like he's somebody who's looking for publicity or trying to make a dollar off this, because he hasn't. Anyway, I was just very impressed with them, man, and very appreciative that they let me in their home to, actually, we must have talked for 2 hours.
Did you go there with Gary Shaw then?
No. Oh. Gary kind of put in a good word for me, because it's my understanding that Ricky and Trisha aren't all that comfortable talking about it with folks they don't know, which is understandable. But, you know, Gary kind of paved the way, and then I drove to their home and interviewed him and drove back home.
So your conclusion is that he's sincere. Whether you accept that story or not is different, but he's not making anything up, and that's over his father and, I guess, the diary. And,
you know, they've received threats. You know, that's talked about in the book and in the interview. And again, if you're being threatened, there's a reason behind it. You would have no reason to threaten somebody if what they're talking about isn't real. There's just a lot to the story that, to me, seems very plausible.
It's also occurred to me that there would be, if you did have a team of assassins, shooters, you might set up secondary teams that would be patsies if something went wrong. That if something really went bad, you could hone in and grab somebody else holding a rifle, or somebody else is, you know, there, or other things. There's, you know, your imagination is free to say, well, we've done this before and we didn't pull it off, or we tried this in Tampa and Chicago and this and that. We've got to have overkill on this.
Yeah.
So
no, certainly possible.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to urge everyone to go to Kennedy's and King, JFK Files, Volume 2. Pieces of the Assassination Puzzle. Jeff Meek is writing about this and been writing for years on the topic. So keep up the good work. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up just about the volume two that wasn't in the first one? That's kind of me.
I think we've touched on a lot of the most interesting. There are several more interviews in there, you know, with people who saw the motorcade and other things. But yeah, I think we've covered it pretty well, Len. And I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk with you about it.
I mean, there's other books or other shows that say Lee did it, or, you know, so I just always happy to interview or promote books that are doing real research. And like you say, you're a journalist. You're just reporting what you found. So
that's right.
Let the
that's
reader,
right?
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then there's some of these stories, anecdotal stuff. You know, but Mark Lane, I think, laid the groundwork of making some of these documentaries and just, you know, interviewing people right away. And you start looking back, and as you've gone through the transcripts and police radios and that, and say, okay, well, what about this? What about that? You know?
Yeah, Mary Farrell was a huge influence on me when I first got started. There's a little bit in Volume 2 about me and Mary Farrell. Sitting down at her kitchen table, I was told that Mary Farrell didn't interview. Well, I interviewed her twice, and that's also in the book. She treated me like gold. I mean, she was still working at that time. This is in the mid-70s. And I'd get up in the morning, and there'd be a pile of documents sitting on her kitchen table, and that's how I spent my day while she was at work. And then we would be up into the wee hours of the night talking and discussing. And the first time I was there, Michael Eddowes was there. I don't know if you even know who that is, but Michael Eddowes is the Englishman, a lawyer who promoted exhuming Lee Harvey Oswald's body. He first wrote Khrushchev Killed Kennedy, and then the later version was called The Oswald File. But he was there doing research at the same time. So it was interesting meeting him. He'd have a driver pull up to Mary's house at a Bentley. And Mary was very inspirational to me. She's the one who suggested I write my first book, which I hand wrote and sent to Mary, and she typed it up. That book is also on Amazon. It's called Lee Harvey Oswald, A Lone Gunman? Question mark. And Mary and I stayed in touch for decades. And she's the reason I did a 9,000 index card filing system, which maybe by the end of this year will be up and available on the Mary Farrell Foundation website. It's being worked on right now.
Very good. For people who never met Mary, give us a little more anecdotes about her, and because I didn't know too much about her.
Well, I don't remember how the name Mary Farrell first came on my radar, but it did. And I wrote her a letter, and she wrote back. And that letter that she wrote back to me is in the front part of my book, The Manipulation of Lee Harvey Oswald. I dedicate that book to Mary. And she was very kind and invited me to come down to her home. We were living in a far western Chicago suburb at that time. And I was a teacher. And when I had Christmas vacation for the next few years, I went down and spent time with her. She was very patient, very giving. She gave me a copy of the Zapruder film in 1975, very, very late 1975. You know, what, 9 months after Robert Groden had the courage to show it on television. Great researcher, had a mountain of materials. She had a little home, little structure in the backyard, just full of books and other items, and German Shepherd in the backyard, and, you know, and all that's now available on the Mary Farrell website. I know some people have written about her being an agent or with the mafia or all this and that, and I saw none of that. I'm a huge fan of Mary Farrell, you know, just how she treated me for years, you know, helped with that very first book, typed the manuscript, etc. She's just a wonderful woman, in my opinion. I cherished the times we had together.
Yeah, very good.
I remember one thing. I'm probably not going to get this exactly right because it happened so many years ago, but I remember I asked her, Mary, have you ever felt afraid? You ever felt threatened? And I'm going to get this mostly right. I don't think she said that. I think she said that she never felt threatened, but she was nervous. I'll use that word for lack of a better one. During the time that she was really investigating the mafia. I remember she did say that to me, that when she was looking into the mafia, and I don't remember her going into any detail. But, you know, another example of how she treated us, you know, my wife came with me the first time, and we were staying, you know, we didn't have any money. We were just staying in a flea bag hotel, and Mary said, no, you're not. And she paid for and put me and my wife up in a nice hotel, and my wife would go shopping during the day, and I would read documents for hours. And then that night we'd stay up and analyze and discuss. And Paul Hoke used to send me a lot of information back in those days as well. That's where I think Mary got a lot of the documents. Mary, myself, Bud Fensterwald, another name some people may remember, and J. Gary Shaw, we were all working really hard back then in the mid-70s on Jean René Suetre, you know, the well-known international French assassin, according to CIA documents, that was in Dallas that day. so yeah, we did a lot together there for a number of years. She was wonderful.
Now, you mentioned Paul Hoke.
Yeah.
Has he changed his view from what the early days were?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'm just not in touch with Paul, you know, one-on-one anymore. Maybe I should be, but not. I don't know. I can't answer that one, Len. Sorry.
No problem. But it sounds like, to me, my first thought is, oh, Gary Mack, you know. Well, there's somebody in the early days that was looking into everything, and then for some reason has come to the conclusion that Lee did it after. I mean, you know, Even they trot out Gerald Posner to discuss these new document releases.
Yeah.
I mean, you just shake your head. You go, you're kidding me, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was really glad to see Jeff Morley and Jim DiAgenio and Oliver Stone be the witnesses at the first task force hearing. I mean, they picked two of the best, three of the best right there. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen from this point on. They say they're going to have some more hearings. They said that they want answers. They want the task force wants answers. The task force wants the Joe Needy's file. And so we'll see what comes of that. It's encouraging. And I don't think, you know, I think most of us that have researched this forever, you know, we don't anticipate seeing a smoking gun document. You know, who would be that stupid to say, Len, you go up in the building and Jeff, you go behind the fence and so on and so forth. But I think we're getting a clearer and clearer picture of the relationship with the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald. And the Schlesinger memo, I think, is really important, too, to show how there are as many or more CIA agents in some of these embassies and facilities than there were State Department people. I mean, they were just...
Yeah, and if you... The memo, examples they have here overthrowing governments in other countries all around the world. I mean, it's just almost everywhere.
Yeah, you read the Schlesinger memo and you can see how just out of control the CIA was.
Or in control.
Yeah, there you go. Autonomous.
Okay, well, sorry for our phone interruptions. I think everything's worked out that way now. So JFK Files Volume 2, Pieces of the Assassination Puzzle, Mr. Jeffrey Meek. And, well, you can get a book from him autographed if you want. I'll include the email address there. You heard it here, though. And, all right, Jen, before we wrap up there, is there anything else you want to talk about?
No. Not about me or what I've done, but just a thank you to you and Black Op Radio for what you do so that we don't have to listen to just the mainstream dribble.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll keep in touch. And good luck on Kennedy's and King. It seems to be they're having links and reviews on everything that's new. So that's
Jim
one.
Jimmy does a great job, doesn't he?
Yeah. All right, okay. Then. Okay.
All right. We'll take care. Thanks so much for the interview. Appreciate it very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we're speaking to Mr. Ray McGinnis, author and journalist. Thank you, Ray, for taking time to talk to me today.
Great to be speaking with you again, Len.
Very good. We both live in Vancouver, Canada, which is good. And we're going to talk about some Canadian news today. You have a new article in the website Propaganda in Focus, and it is a verdict in the trial of Tamara Leitch and Chris Barber. Let's bring people up to speed. This is about the trucker convoy that went to Ottawa to protest, saying, like, you've got to take us seriously. We want somebody to come out of the building there and meet with us. And nobody ever did. So this is just from May 20th, 2025. So it's up to date. So I give you the floor.
Yeah. So this is a trial of Tamara Leitch and Chris Barber were two of the more visible faces in the media of the Freedom Convoy protesters. It was established in the trial, and the judge agreed that there were actually numerous different convoys that came from the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast and southwestern Ontario, and that Chris Barber and Tamara Leitch didn't have any control over the various groups and couldn't order them around or weren't even known by many of the protesters, never had encounters with many of them nonetheless. Tamara Leitch and Chris Barber were in the eye of the media. Tamara Leitch did a press conference, I think, on the 3rd of February, 2022 in Ottawa, where she was. explaining why people had come to Ottawa. And as a result of that and her involvement with encouraging people to crowdfund for GoFundMe and GiveSendGo, she was somebody who the media kept showing photos of and kind of like, this is the public face of the Freedom Convoy. As well, she and Chris Barber, even more so, I think, were in contact with police liaison team members of the Ottawa Police Service, City of Ottawa, in an effort to ensure that emergency lanes remained clear, that people were peaceful and respectful in their interactions with the protest, with the police, the protesters and the police. There was not a single point during the protest where any punch was thrown or anyone kicked anybody. Nobody was charged in Ottawa up until the point that the police cracked down with batons and horses on the protesters. But there was no, they were arrested, these two people arrested on mischief charges and obstruction, obstructing police and intimidation and counseling intimidation. And they had six counts against them altogether. And the police, so what happened was, let me say that people, why they were there was because in pre-pandemic, in quotes, times, generally when people wanted to talk to their member of parliament about whether they were in opposition or in the government and about a policy, they could have a chance to meet with them or talk to them. Or they would get phone calls or emails, and all of that would result in something constructive in terms of a communication. And from the outset during the pandemic, whatever the measures were, the response of the government was to ignore and just send back canned talking points like the science is settled. Follow the science, safe and effective, and so on. And people were 120,000 businesses, according to Stats Canada. Small businesses went bankrupt in 2020 alone as a result of the lockdown measures. And so many ordinary Canadians, working class Canadians especially, were suffering economically as well as mentally and emotionally. Suicides were up, addictions were up, depression was up. So people felt that they needed to have some kind of an answer from the government besides these talking points and assurances. And when the government decided in Canada that truck drivers entering Canada would be required to quarantine for 14 days, which would mean that they would only be able to work 2 days a month, because you come across the border in Canada, now you're quarantining at home for 2 weeks to get to go across the border one more time and back in at home for 14 days. It's not a way to make a living. So that was the catalyst for the protest. Prime Minister Trudeau basically called people an unacceptable fringe minority. He said that he would not meet with these people and went into a kind of hanging out in an undisclosed location out of concern for, I guess he received at that point, I think he had COVID for the third time. So the protesters said, well, we're going to dig in our heels and we're going to wait until someone comes and talks to us. They had many doctors, nurses, paramedics had been fired, and others who were there along with the truck drivers and many farmers and people from all walks of life. And so the protesters, initially, when they arrived, some on the 28th of January, 2022, and the great majority on the 29th of January of 2022, people were honking horns and people were, there was a lot of noise throughout the day and into the early evening by quite a number of accounts that I've read. That horn honking in the evening had been restricted to 6 p.m. by about the 2nd of February. And then there was an injunction by a provincial court judge to stop the honking entirely. And that was on the 7th of February.
If you don't mind me interrupting, the thing that always got my interest was that what they were there for is demanding their government would represent them. So they're outside, instead of banging on the door, honking horns and say, come on out and address this. We want to meet with somebody. You've got to do something. And they wouldn't do anything, but they would make it, oh, you got to stop honking your horn then.
Well, and I guess when a person is honking a horn in traffic normally, they're honking the horn because someone else proximate to them, beside them or ahead of them, usually is doing something that needs to be called out. You know, you're running a red light, whatever it is, and the other driver is concerned about the other person's behavior. So it's a way of saying, pay attention, listen to me. And I think, I mean, in the history of Canadian protests, I mean, in Ottawa, on a typical year, you know, since World War II, has had about 100 days a year of some group protesting. Maybe it's gotten more numerous over the last two or three decades. But in any event, Ottawa is used to having protests, and a prime minister or a cabinet minister or a deputy minister routinely will go out onto Parliament Hill, where most of the protests happen, and other places adjacent, and talk to the protesters. It doesn't mean that they talk and agree. They agree about some things, maybe disagree about other things, but there's a conversation that happens. And it may not satisfy the protesters that are protesting topic of the day. But nonetheless, that's been the habit. And so there was good reason for the protesters coming to Ottawa to anticipate that somebody, either the health minister, minister of health, or somebody would come to have a conversation. And this didn't happen. And in a way, it was quite unprecedented in terms of the government thumbing its nose at the protesters in this way.
Right. So it was kind of an ad hoc association. People just decided they were showing up. People brought their families. And these two, among a few others, were kind of singled out of saying, well, they're somehow organizing it. It doesn't seem to be very organized, but they're the only people we can pin down as a spokesman. So we've got to charge them with something. I mean, mischief, you know, whenever I hear like a criminal charge of mischief, I always think like, what the hell's that, you know?
Well, mischief trials in Canada typically last about 3 hours in the court. And a mischief trial may be to do with somebody who's a repeat offender of graffiti, or people, you know, not knocking over garbage cans after a rock and roll concert, or, you know, sporting event. It's often people carousing. And so the Crown will slap the wrists of the people who've been out
right.
of control.
I guess what we're saying is if it was a serious charge, there would be a crime for it. There would be something for it. So but when you use the mischief, like you're mentioning, like if there's noise bylaws, they have bylaws for noise, right? You're after 10 yeah. o'clock or whatever, but it always seems to me to be so light and they don't even have a law for it. So we'll just call it mischief.
Yeah. And as we talk, you'll see what's happened is that a charge of mischief has really been weaponized in the instance of these and other people protesting in Freedom Convoy, and the whole understanding of what it means of the right to protest in public property. The goalposts have shifted. Canadians and those who care about Canada may not know, you know, what all of this means, but this particular trial and its verdict have some implications for public protests going forward.
All right. So up to date then, there's this court case been going on for a little while.
Yeah, on and off for 45, 46 days. And actually, right today, as we speak, there's a stay of proceedings for Chris Barber for today, tomorrow, and Friday. So, you know, it kind of like, and then there's going to be a sentencing for Tamara Leach, at least, if not Chris Barber as well, and later on in July. So it's like it's the longest mischief trial in Canadian history.
Right. Now, for those don't know, what does a stay mean?
A stay of proceedings is, that's where the lawyer for the defendant is arguing that they've been given legal counsel, and the statement by the judge, a provincial court judge, in the injunction to stop honking horns, who then said, you protesters have the right to continue to peacefully protest here in Ottawa. And so they're saying that the defendant, Chris Barber, had reason to believe that he had the right to protest in Ottawa, that was not a problem. And so they're saying, let's have all of the charges dropped because he had reason to believe that he was acting as a law-abiding citizen in this instance.
Right. And then the prosecution has to react to that.
Yes. The prosecution will be saying, no, the charge still stands. So we'll find out by Friday what the result of that on the 23rd of May, what the result of the stay of proceedings argument is. Maybe I should say what the charges were. The charges were mischief, intimidation, counseling others to obstruct police, obstructing police, that they did wrongfully and without authority, lawful authority, compel other persons to abstain from doing anything that the person had the lawful right to do, and mischief. Anyway, so the court found both Tamara Litch and Chris Barber guilty of mischief. And they found Chris Barber guilty of disobeying a court order, which was not committed. And that is in relationship to the honking of the horns. And I'll just say one thing about that separate count that Chris Barber was found guilty on. The court injunction on February 7th was to stop honking horns. And late in the protest, when it was clear that there would be a heavy police action, police came on mounted horses and with lots of batons and a whole new bunch of police officers that had not been dealing with the protest that were ready to kind of like the Incredible Hulk, it's clobbering time. And so Chris Barber had said on TikTok that if the police come in with shields and everything and are looking menacing, honk your horns. So although it's not clear that anyone honked their horn because Chris Barber said to honk their horns, which is why the language is disobeying a court order, which was not committed. So even though it's not proven that anyone in fact honked their horns as a result of Chris Barber saying, honk your horns if the police come and start smashing the windows of your truck, which they did do. Numerous trucks were just needlessly smashed and vandalized by the police. But never mind. Because Chris Barber said this, he's guilty of the second count.
All right. It's still in news. It's on and on. I shudder to estimate how much the Crown has spent on this, how much money.
Oh, several millions of dollars. Yeah. And the Crown is saying, like, this is not about their political views. The Crown's also conceded that their presence in Ottawa was not unlawful, but they said that they were the means that they used to express by going to Ottawa and then having, you know, vehicles parked in the city of Ottawa on Wellington Street and other streets that were all positioned as a result of local police officers waving individual truck drivers forward and pointing and saying, you park here. You know, so what the defense ended up, the defense said that the charter rights to peacefully assemble and protest and the freedom of expression versus the right of enjoyment of public property must be paramount. But the Crown argued no. If somebody wanted to go and enjoy this public property, or if they felt that their ability to get through traffic around Wellington Street was impeded and their enjoyment of getting from A to B was longer than they would like, that should be paramount. And so what's disturbing about this is that you have all kinds of police testifying about the cooperative nature of the interaction with key volunteers with the protest, like Chris Barber and Tamara Leach. Like Sergeant Sear of the Ottawa Police said that she understood there was no violence and the truckers had to register. They had a code of conduct all about, you know, before any of the truck drivers were allowed in the protest, they had to sign off on a code of conduct about peaceful, nonviolent behavior. And you have different inspectors, Inspector Russell Lucas, talking about moving trucks to different streets to help consolidate the footprint of the vehicles, protest vehicles in downtown Ottawa, away from any residential buildings. And the those efforts by some police officers were impaired by the obstruction of higher-ups in the Ottawa Police Service. So on the one hand, you've got protesters being blamed for being in some residential downtown areas or where there's residents, but the reason why they're not able to move entirely into the commercial area of the downtown is because people in the higher ups in the Ottawa Police Service are preventing that from happening. So the judges has decided to come down with a verdict about the enjoyment of property versus the right to protest. And she says that, you know, she read some books about the enjoyment. You know, she says, at the heart of the competing interests in this case lies the question, to what extent does the exercise of the right to protest protect those from criminal liability when the rights of other citizens to enjoy their property have been impacted by their actions? And she says, even charter protected rights are not absolute. So if I wanted to have a protest in Stanley Park in Vancouver, our big park in the city, I could do that. But maybe somebody else would say, well, we don't like where Ray McGinnis is protesting because we wanted to have a picnic there. So then maybe I should be charged with mischief because I prevented somebody else from the enjoyment of having a picnic in a public park where I was protesting. You've got a verdict now, which is going to make it very difficult for the average person to understand where they can protest, because one of the things that the judge cited was a case in, I think, New Brunswick, where someone was sitting down on a roadway to protest something happening with First Nations people, and they may have only been sitting in that roadway for 3 minutes. Nonetheless, there was a mischief charge in that case as well. And so what the judge said in the verdict for Tamara Leach and Chris Barber was, it doesn't matter what the duration of the protest is, you can still be found guilty of mischief. Now, if somebody can be found guilty of mischief, as apparently happened in New Brunswick, for just 3 minutes of making a, you know, making your driving your point home by obstructing a roadway for 3 minutes, it's hard to know, you know, what would be the case where someone could confidently say, I'm going to protest in this city square or in that park or on that street, and be confident that you might not be charged with mischief, especially if you end up being the person falls to you to be the person liaising with police to make sure everybody's peaceful and obeying the law. So I think that Canadians will now need to simply look to see which way the political winds are blowing. If it seems that the government in power would smile supportively on your intention to protest topic A, then you can maybe go off and protest. And we have sometimes protests in Vancouver where people are blocking the only artery, one of the two only arteries from North Vancouver, the North Shore to Vancouver, the Stanley Park Causeway, because they're protesting something about the environment or some other thing. And the police let that happen routinely, which is a great inconvenience to people in Vancouver, because your options for getting to the North Shore then are greatly impeded, and you're going to take a lot more time to get over to the North Shore, another half an hour at least. And I want to also mention one other thing about the noise. And I'm certainly nobody who likes car alarms or horn honking. It was pointed out to me by someone who's a friend of mine in Vancouver that at the time of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics, alongside the Olympics, there was an area called the Olympic Zone, centered in Robson Square, where there was music, quite loud music, that started at 7 a.m. each day and went on till after midnight. The Olympics and the city of Vancouver advertised this as the largest party ever, in quotes. And the partying went on. People's, you know, up Robson and Thurlow, further west, Butte and Thurlow, could hear the loud music and the partiers from 7 a.m. to 3 a.m. And one person I talked with recently about that said that for 17 days, they could only get 4 hours of sleep a night. But the message back in 2010 in Vancouver, because of that kind of noise infraction, as I'll call it, was that the reason for the noise was this great Olympic celebration. And so the message to all area residents in that area of the downtown of Vancouver was just put up with it or go away. You know, go plan to have a holiday somewhere else. But when you have people that went to Ottawa that are saying our charter rights for mobility, our rights to make a livelihood, our rights of freedom of speech and peaceful assembly are all under attack. If they come and make a noise about that, that's unacceptable. That's part of what the unacceptable fringe minority does. And that's why we're going to charge you with mischief and hound you and make you spend $1 million defending yourself, as is the case with these two. So it seems that we have a lot of amnesia in our country about other times and places where there's been noise, for example, and we don't think about how we seem to have all kinds of rules to the exception.
Okay, so where does that leave us? We're waiting for Friday for the latest update?
We're waiting for the Friday for the latest update regarding Chris Barber's lawyers to attempt to get his charges dismissed. There will be a sentencing, I think, on the 23rd, 24th, 25th of July for Tamara Leach. If Chris Barber's not successful with a stay of proceedings, then he will also be at that sentencing in later part of July. So that's where we are. And I think I want to add that Celia Farber, who's a great writer over in American writer, but in Spain, wrote a long piece about Reiner Fulmich, who was one of the people challenging COVID policies. And he's just gone to prison for 3 years and 9 months in Germany. And she said about his case that he did do something wrong. He challenged and unmasked the COVID, you know, lies. And as she said, but in Germany, the government, they don't persecute the many, they choose the one. And in Canada also, I mean, there were, you know, tens of thousands of people over the 3 weeks in Ottawa who were protesting, but the government isn't going after every single person who protested there. They're going after select numbers of people, dozens and dozens of people like Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, to keep stories in the news, court cases in the news, to remind the general public that these people who protested in Ottawa did something unacceptable, which, you know, and so we're going to keep driving home the message that you must not, you know, raise questions about government policy or protest it when the government shuts down any communication to have a discussion about it, short of public protesting and even including public protesting. And I'll also quote from my article that Václav Havel, who was a dissident in Czechoslovakia, wrote an essay in 1978 called The Power of the Powerless. And he said, "You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career. You were thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You were cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well, or to stand up as a citizen and say, 'Hey, government, there's some problems here.' But it ends up with being branded an enemy of the state." And so I think that where we are now in Canada is that the government now is free from time to time to put whoever it wants in its crosshairs and make an example of them, to scapegoat them, and to keep other people in the general public nervous about what they say and what they do. And that's not good for democracy.
Yeah, especially that now, looking back with hindsight, what the government was saying about safe and effective, the records are showing out, no, that was a lie. Not just an error, that was just a total lie. All the mandatory things that have to go along with this case, they don't want anybody really talking about that. They just want to say these people were a threat to your safe being, you know. Just like you know, they said there was Nazis in the crowd. They said it was, you know, they stopped people from even donating money because so many people donated. They go, I can't be there, but I'd like to support what you're doing.
Exactly. On the state side, there's a brand new documentary called Follow the Silenced, as opposed to Science, Follow the Silenced, which you can go to followthesilenced.com. I'll give you a link for this for your show. And Breanne Dressen and other people who got vaccinated in the States tell their stories about what happened next in the case of these people who didn't have the happy experience of having a vaccine and then carrying on with life as normal. They've gone through being shut down and ignored, and you know, so it's yeah, it continues to be the case that that people have had bad side effects
or died suddenly. I knew two people.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who died of COVID, but I know two people who died suddenly. And I suspect that, you know, and without, yeah, you know, proving it, I won't make a big deal of it. But it's just like that is strange. I'd like to see if there's more documents of how many people had these adverse reactions compared to how many people got well. Dr. John, you know, he's on the internet, and he was just saying one of the things for flu vaccination had like about a 30%, I can't think of the right word, not failure rate, but out of 100 people who didn't have this vaccination, nobody got the flu. But of 100 people that did have the vaccination, you know, 30 of them caught the flu. So more people caught the flu after being vaccinated than those who didn't.
Yes. And I mean,
negative reaction. There was a better word he used for it.
You know, it's, I mean, I finally create a little document in my computer of all the curious incidents of family members, relatives, friends of mine telling me stories since the spring of 2021 of people who got vaccinated and then suddenly have ended up with just a real difficult health
issue, yeah,
crisis.
Yeah.
You know, or like I was visiting an aunt recently in Calgary with my mother, and my aunt had turned 90. And she just happened to mention when I asked about one of my cousins who's down in Utah, just happened to mention, well, oh, and by the way, my cousin Stephen's wife, who has three, you know, grew up with her three sisters, two of them, I think a couple of years ago, you know, they got vaccinated, probably boosted. And two of these sisters were in their mid to late 40s, healthy and fine. Physicals were all showing everything's fine. And then they've gotten recently vaccinated. And then within a couple of weeks, two or three weeks, one had all of a sudden an onset of three different cancers and died quite quickly, like in a matter of 10 days. And the other sister suddenly had a headache one day. The next day she collapsed on the floor in the house in Oregon. And then she was in the hospital. She had like about 14 or 15 blood clots and died, you know, so, you know, and I don't have the autopsy reports, but
yeah, just anecdotal, just the stories you've heard. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had anecdotal stories of people throughout my life who suddenly someone's 45, they have a heart attack or whatever, but it was very uncommon. I'm finding when I add it all up, I have quite a numerous
well, the fact
now,
that a government told you it's mandatory.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know what, I've looked at it, I've weighed the options, I'm going to have it, you know? Or, you know, Well, we don't have to go through that right now. I just want to make sure people knew that you have your article up, and this is what the latest state is of this. Because like I had was talking about, in the UK there, they are arresting people under thought crimes. They're saying, you're if you didn't write this tweet, but you've retweeted, you're guilty of something, you know. And they seem to be very light. It's not like people say, go out and get your shotguns and take to the streets and start shooting. It's nothing like that. It's like, you know, I object to this or I object to that. How about you? And it's just unbelievable.
Well, and you're right to be mentioning this in the UK, because we have a sitting Liberal government that had seriously considered several online harms bills, so-called, regarding hate speech, until the government, you know, has prorogued itself. We haven't had a sitting parliament since last October. But they are, I understand that they are ready to bring forth legislation to deal with social media, to look seriously at censorship, which could be, if the language of the proposed bill back in the fall ends up finding its way into the language of a new bill that would go forward this spring or summer, we could find ourselves in a place where people are being accused of committing future hate crimes, or the possibility of committing future hate crimes. And this kind of vagueness opens up a huge can of worms for individual citizens that want to snitch on someone else for any number of reasons to get them in trouble with the law around this kind of a vague kind of legislation, which in the way it's worded could end up having people being fined or imprisoned. Yeah, imprisoned for, I forget how many years was it going to be, like 10 years or something, if you know, for committing, for the future possibility of committing a crime, we're going to put you in jail to prevent you from doing that. We can't, you know, so it's kind of Kafka-esque kind of a world if we get to that place. So, yeah.
All right, Ray. Same well, thing. I look forward to following anything you write and your research, and just keep in touch always. And I think people here at Black Op Radio are also interested. I mean, they can tune in or not tune in, but if they want to hear what's going on, we're trying to make sure that this stays in the news.
Well, and I'll just mention one last thing, which is next week I am going to be going with a friend driving up to Edgewood.
Going? Oh, yeah. Hats
so I'm
off to you.
Going to go and visit the Universal Ostrich Farm and see for myself these beautiful 400 some ostriches that are being that are in the crosshairs of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. These ostriches.
Oh, well, I really would like a report if you want to do that for Black Op Radio. We'll keep in touch via email, and I'd love to have an on-the-spot report because I've been following them on Facebook, but it looked good for a while, and now it's back to wherever, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll do a whole show just on that.
Okay, great. Take care.
Okay, thank you very much for your time then.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.